Hello, I'm Tim McLaughlin, and this is a Maywa podcast. In this episode, we present the second part of Rosemary Krill's lecture, The Cotton Road. The talk was given as part of the Maywa Textile Symposium and was recorded live on October 24th, 2007. In part two, Rosemary Krill will explore the trade in cottons that took place with Western markets and the craze for chintz, which combined British, Indian, and even Chinese elements into an exotic hybrid.
Now, let's look a bit more closely at the trade with the West. As I mentioned, the Portuguese were the first Europeans to come to India. Vasco da Gama made his famous voyage to India by sea in 1498. And very soon after that, the Portuguese set up trading posts. And one of the first things that they started to send back, as well as wonderful woodwork and mother-of-pearl inlaid chests and things like that, all made to Portuguese forms, but done by Indian craftsmen. One of the first other things were these wonderful embroideries. These are just details. They tend to be very large, but I've just shown details to show the two main different types. Oh, the top one is of a sort of, the background is left plain and the design is done in a sort of running stitch. The bottom one, the design is done in a sort of much denser, often a chain stitch, and the background is sort of textured by little running stitches. The sort of yellowy colour that you see here is tussar silk. Which is, of course, what Bengal was famous for. It's the natural coloured brownish silk of the region. And that it doesn't take dye very well. And that's why most of these Portuguese market embroideries are rather sort of monochrome in this sort of yellowish brown colour. Several of them were made specifically for Portuguese families, so you quite often find them with coats of arms or biblical stories or scenes from myth, like the labours of Hercules or something like that, or others, just like the one, the detail on the right is just a sort of a generic hunting scene showing Western hunters shooting creatures. I hope you can see this one. It's a beautiful piece, but it's, as I said, it was, you know, they're very monochrome. You don't get that sort of vivid contrast of colours that you get in so many other Indian textiles. This is just the tussar silk on a cotton ground. And again, you can see the Western-style figures wearing Western dress, hunting, and wonderful sort of lions with arrows and so on. Now, as I mentioned, the Portuguese were thrown out of Hooghly in Bengal in 1630, so that's a sort of rather useful cut-off date for when these were probably made. Now, when the British East India came along in 1600, they also did not lose any time in starting to send textiles back from India to Britain. These are embroideries done by that same Mochi community that we saw in the Mughal piece a few slides ago. But this is done probably in the late 17th century, obviously very much to Western taste. Now, how did this happen? We know that by about 1640, the East India Company were sending out actual designs of textiles to be copied in India. And these sometimes were copied faithfully, sometimes they underwent a sort of wonderful amalgamation at the hands of the Indian craftsmen. And this, while it owes something to Jacobean crewel work embroidery, has undergone just such a transformation. It's become something very exotic and wonderful. And it also shows up the amazing dyeing skills of the time. The very, very dark blue is, of course, indigo, but re-dyed and re-dyed to get that really deep blue. And the pink, the bright pink, is achieved by a mixture of lac dyeing and madder. Sometimes the embroideries were part of a set of bed hangings which could combine embroidery and painted cotton or chintz, and this is just such a situation where on the left you've got an embroidered hanging with these wonderful sort of exotic trees growing out of this rockery in the bottom, and on the right is the painted cotton or chintz version. Perhaps I should just say a word about the word chintz. It's an anglicization of a Dutch form of an Indian word, which originally meant to sort of sprinkle or spatter, which is not what you might think would apply to such a beautifully hand and finished cloth. But this seems to be the etymology. Everyone seems to agree. When I ask Indian friends, what does chint mean to you? They always make this gesture. It's sprinkling. And some chintzes do have this sort of sprinkled colour in the background. So it's possible that that was their origin rather than a very fine painting. So here we've got a parallel embroidered and chintz design, which is logistically remarkable when you consider that the embroidery was done in Gujarat in northwest India, then the chintz was done on the Coromandel coast in southeast India. So obviously a design, in fact, this design, was sent to both places to be copied. The black and white picture on the bottom is of an English crewel work embroidery in the Boston Museum of Fine Arts. And there's another piece in the Burrell collection in Glasgow. But you can see that it must have been either the model for the chintz above, or perhaps they both came from another common source. But certainly the chintz is very close with this, for example, this little... It's reversed, so there must be... there must have been a tracing at some stage. So here we have this little man looking out here, and here he is looking out here, for example. And these sort of large, rather typical English Jacobean sort of flowers have become rather more exotic in the chintz. I just thought I'd also show you, just to make clear what an amazing difference it would have made to have painted cottons come into your life at the beginning of the 17th century in England. On the left is an English crewel work embroidered flower. On the right, an early 18th century painted cotton or chintz. Now, at the beginning of the 17th century, when the East India Company was set up, no one in Europe really had cotton. There was a little bit of cotton grown in Italy, but no one in Britain would use it as a normal thing in their lives. Linen was the usual thing for dress, or wool, of course. Silk from France or Italy if you were very rich. But something as light and fine and washable as cotton was not known. So not only did this new fabric introduce a whole new feeling to what you wore and what you furnished your house with, which was before this very sort of heavy, a twill ground with heavy woolen embroidery, so quite a chunky fabric. So you can imagine the feeling of relief when this very light and beautifully coloured Indian stuff came along. Everyone went absolutely wild. The other thing about the chintz was that the actual patterning of fabrics was very, well, basic, I suppose, in Europe at that time. Unless you were rich enough to have an elaborately woven design, the most you were going to get was either an embroidery of rather coarse nature or a block print which would not be fast. It couldn't be washed. As I said right at the beginning, these dyes were not, the dyes that were used in Britain were not very fast. They had indigo in the form of woad, which was not as strong as the Indian indigo. They had madder, but although these things, you know, worked quite well on wool, there wasn't a very wide range of patterned textiles. So for the first time, really sort of elaborately patterned designs were available to people who had never normally had them. This is just an illustration of the sort of difference between the very sort of thick, and of course the other thing about wall hangings were normally heavy tapestries made of wool, and suddenly these chintz hangings appeared, which completely changed the way an interior would have looked. By about the 1640s, the British were showing serious interest in chintz, as it were, in its own right. When the East India Company first arrived in India, they'd been interested in Indian textiles only for one reason, and that was to sell them in Indonesia to get spices. The Indonesians only wanted Indian textiles in exchange for their spices. The British wanted pepper, they wanted nutmeg, they wanted cardamom or whatever, and they could only buy them with Indian textiles, which they attempted to do. It was only in about 1619 or so that someone thought, well, actually, these are quite interesting. Don't you think they might be able to sell at home? And so by about 1618, Indian chintzes, or as they were then called, they were called by the Portuguese name, pintado, were actually on sale in London for the first time. This is the same hanging that we saw before, and I just, again, wanted to contrast it with a crewel work bed. This is an English crewel work bed on the right in a house called Coathill in England. And this is a very typical sort of bed set with these sort of tree forms coming out of the rockery at the bottom. So this is exactly what this was replicating and used to exchange the crewel work for chintz. And this, I must apologise for this extremely bad photo, but it's the only one I've ever seen of this bed. This belonged to Prince Eugene of Savoy, and he had his bed hung with this set. It's the same design of chintz hangings, and he was obviously in the sort of forefront of fashion at the end of the 17th century. Now, trees were really the sort of main design for chintzes for the Western market right from the beginning. Some people like to call them tree of life. I don't. I think they're just trees. Now, there was already a fashion for what was called branched hangings in England by the mid-17th century. And I have a little quotation here that says there is a great practice of printing large branches for hangings in rooms. And we do believe that some of our calicoes painted after this manner might vent well, and therefore have sent you some patterns. So obviously this is a sort of thing that was being sent out in order to decorate rooms at the beginning of the 18th century or the late 17th. Very beautiful, very sort of hybrid taste, with a little bit of sort of Chinese in there, a little bit of English. So this was at the beginning of the whole taste for chinoiserie that was really going to hit Europe in the 18th century, when people didn't know the difference between Chinese and Japanese or Indian, and they would call Chinese wallpaper Indian wallpaper, they would call Japanese lacquer Indian work. It was all just exotic. And so all this fed into a very sort of hybrid style. The Dutch were very fond of big, chunky flowers. This, the one on the left, this is what's called a palempore or hanging. And this, it's massive. It must be, I don't know, 15 feet high. So this huge tree in the centre is very much to the Dutch taste, as is the border with these very beautiful, simple flowers in a sort of meander, which you see on Dutch Batavian or Javanese colonial furniture of the time, and also silver work. So it's all part of a sort of trend in Dutch and British interiors of the time. The one on the right was also probably made under Dutch patronage, maybe for use in Sri Lanka. It's a little bit smaller, and we found some pieces in Sri Lanka that correspond to that sort of size. The Dutch were also very fond of pink and red grounds for their chintzes, like this piece on the left. There are some splendid remarks by the British East India Company representatives in India saying, oh, the Dutch have taken all the red cloths, we are left with the white ones, but the Dutch obviously really liked this pink or red background. On the right is a reconstruction of a Dutch interior of the 18th century, and you can see the pink ground chintz hangings on the walls. These would have been mounted on battens and sort of put like panels on the wall. And it's interesting that it's sort of in tandem with, this is a, you can hardly see it, but it's a tapestry. And of course, the woolen tapestry was very much on the way out at this time. Chintzes were taking over. Chinese elements were incredibly popular too, again, as a part of this whole chinoiserie trend. And so we have these Chinese ladies based on famous Chinese sets of beauties, which were collected as paintings. And on the right, all the border is made up of these sort of chinoiserie baskets of flowers, which are like something off a piece of Chinese enamel. So furnishings and bed hangings and wall hangings and curtains were really what were the first demands for chintzes. For example, in 1663, we know that Samuel Pepys bought some chintz to line his wife's study, which must have looked very, very beautiful. But there were other earlier types of chintz. For example, this curious thing, which has been adapted into a sort of bed cover, in the centre has the royal coat of arms of the House of Stuart. So it's probably made with reference to Charles II in the sort of middle of the 17th century. It's got these lovely pineapples on two sides. The pineapple was introduced into Britain, I think, in about 1640. So it can't be earlier than that. Maybe it's even a reference to, you know, the amazing new fruit. But again, you can see the sort of very Chinese-y style of a lot of these creatures used in this bedspread. Oh, here's the pineapple bigger. So quite a hybrid piece. The French, who didn't have so much of a chintz fetish as did the British and the Dutch, but they also bought into it to a certain extent, but they went for a rather more sort of classical style, like the piece on the left, which is just a detail of a large hanging derived from patterns made by Jean Berrin, who was the court designer at Versailles under Louis the 14th. And he made these very sort of classical, rather stiff designs, which were obviously sent out to India to be copied as chintz for the French market. And on the right is another of these very big-scale Dutch pieces with these massive palmettes. This one is rather interesting because it's quilted, but probably used as a wall hanging rather than as a bed cover. We know that quilted wall hangings were quite popular, just partly because there are letters saying, please don't send us any more quilted wall hangings. We want the thin ones. So obviously the quilted ones were perhaps seen as a more appropriate exchange for heavy tapestries. Now dress, chintz dress became popular around the end of the 17th century. First in Holland, in 1683, the East India Company writes that chintz is the wear of gentlewomen in Holland, but they're trying to sort of raise its status in Britain. And so they ask, please send us chintz lengths of better quality. And they say 200,000 of all sorts will not be too much. I mean, this is a really huge amount of stuff. And of course, it should also be remembered that while what we think of as Indian cotton imports are these beautiful hand-painted chintzes, millions of pieces of far more ordinary stuff is what the bread and butter of the company was. Plain cottons or striped cottons or checked cottons for sheets, for underwear, for shirts, just for everyday use. And this is just the very sort of elite end. So evidently that demand of 1683 worked, because by 1687, chintz had also become the fashion in Britain for ladies of the greatest quality. And they even would wear chintz on the outside of their dresses, but in order to show that they had plenty of money and they could afford it, they would line their chintz with silk or even velvet or sometimes even cloth of gold. So because this was so fashionable, they wanted to put it on the outside. But unfortunately, it was a bit cheap. It wasn't as expensive as these wonderful French and Italian silks. So, but they wanted to make it clear that they could afford the expensive materials, and also to give that wonderful rustle of silk. So this was all partly as a result of a sort of public relations campaign that the East India Company embarked on very aggressively to market chintz. In around the 1680s. They even sent chintz garments out to fashionable people, including the king himself, who deigned to appear in a an Indian-style waistcoat at one point. And in 1688, Dutch fashions, and as I mentioned, chintz dress took off first in Holland. Dutch fashions were very much given a boost in Britain when the Dutch monarchs William and Mary came to the throne in 1688. So it was becoming hugely popular. And in 1694, the East India Company representative writes, "You can never send us too many chintzes." So, of course, this led to terrible anguish amongst the local weavers in Britain, and chintz was actually prohibited. It was banned. It was banned in Britain in 1700, although the law that banned it had very little effect because it was okay to bring chintz in if you were then going to re-export it, for example, to another of the colonies, to Africa or somewhere like that. So what would happen would be that the chintzes would come in and the customs man would say, okay, yes, where's it going? And the captain of the ship would say, oh, we're going off tomorrow to West Africa or America. And they would, in fact, go round the corner to Kent and unload their chintzes. And all these fashionable ladies would go down to Deal in Kent and buy prohibited chintzes. It was obviously a huge, you know, bit of a thrill for these ladies. So then laws were passed trying to force people to wear British wool for 6 months of the year, or they forbade servants from wearing cotton caps. They tried everything. They passed a law saying you had to be buried in a British woolen shroud. But of course, people wouldn't be dictated to. Once they'd got the taste for cotton, it wouldn't be denied, as it were. So another act was brought in 1720, which also forbade the use of it. But it obviously had very little effect because most of the chintzes that survive, in fact, are from the period of Prohibition. And there are dramatic scenes in about 1719 leading up to this second act. There were massive mobs of weavers because, of course, it was the linen and wool weavers whose livelihood was at stake. They marched on the House of Commons, something like 6,000 weavers marched on the House of Commons demanding that this Indian cotton be outlawed. And they would physically tear chintz dresses off people's backs if they saw them in the street. So, I mean, you know, we think of textiles as a rather sort of gentle, nice thing to be interested in, but it really was a huge political issue at the time because people's very livelihoods were at stake. So just a few more examples of chintz dress. On the left, this monochrome sort of black on white was for mourning. There are other black on white dresses. And on the right, this rather beautiful floral skirt with its the top is unpatterned because obviously you're going to be wearing a jacket over it. Now, we've heard that ladies of the greatest quality or whatever were wearing chintzes, but one of the main things that people didn't like about chintzes was that people of all classes of society could afford it, and also that ladies of the greatest quality would pass on their chintzes to their servants who wore it as special wear. So people going around great houses complained that you can no longer tell who's the mistress and who's the servant because they're all wearing chintzes. Even the queen herself, Queen Caroline, was wearing chintzes. And as Daniel Defoe, the author Daniel Defoe, one of the greatest opponents of chintz, one of the greatest defendants of the English weavers, put it, you know, who would have thought that this stuff that was once on the beds is now on the back of our queen, and isn't this a disgrace that everybody's wearing this Indian stuff? Oh, here are just two jackets of the type that would have been worn over the skirts. You can see that some of this is quite sort of large scale, partly because as chintz dress became more fashionable, the furnishings were often cut down and made into clothing. So you can see that it would have been an extraordinary thing suddenly to have people walking around in what was previously bed hangings. It must have been a huge shock. Now, men, of course, were not exempt from the chintz craze. Samuel Pepys again, in 1661, he bought himself a chintz gown. And in 1670, Molière wrote in Le Bourgeois Gentilhomme that he has his gentilhomme saying, oh, I must get myself an Andienne, as they were called in France, as his tailor. My tailor tells me it's what people of quality wear in the mornings. And of course, the chintz was still a rather informal material, whether it was furnishings in which it would be used in minor bedrooms, dressing rooms, whereas the very important bedrooms would still be got up with amazing French and Italian silks, or of dress. Chintz dress was usually worn at home or in the mornings. You wouldn't necessarily go out to a great ball wearing your chintz dress. It's very much a sort of informal but very fashionable thing. They were called, now these are called banyans in England because of a sort of misguided misunderstanding of the word banya, which is just a sort of merchant in India. The East India Company, for some reason, called the garments after the merchants and called them banyans. In Holland, they were actually called Japanese gowns, which I think is perhaps more indicative of where the styles really came from. It's quite like a sort of Japanese kimono. And they weren't normally worn outside, except in places like Bath in England, where, of course, people were going to and from the hot baths all the time. And so they were often in a state of semi-undress. And they were worn much more normally during the day by men in the colonies, where one visitor reported that they were shocking clothes for gentlemen, which I think they're rather lovely. So chintz was in a way the victim of its own success, because the demand was so great that local imitations started to be made. I mean, one could almost say that the Industrial Revolution took place because a means was needed for imitating chintz, both in spinning and weaving cotton and in dyeing it and printing it. No one ever discovered how to do the real chintz hand drawing and dyeing. But the European, especially in France and Alsace, they started to evolve methods of printing whereby you could print as complicated a pattern without having to import it from India. So these, a combination of prohibition and the availability of local imitations, really sort of spelled the end, if you like, of the chintz trend.
You've been listening to part two of The Cotton Road. In the third and final part, Rosemary Krill will look at Indian muslins and the fine cashmere shawls that were worn with them. These were the next great fashion to be based on Indian imports to Europe. After the conclusion of her talk, Rosemary Krill takes questions from the audience. Rosemary's lecture was recorded live at the Mewa Textile Symposium on October 24th, 2007. For more information on Mewa or our podcasts, please visit our website at www.mewa.com. I'm Tim McLaughlin. Thank you for listening.